Hello and welcome to Minbar. I'm your host, Ahmed Hanif. James Baldwin, the great African-American novelist, said more than 60 years ago that racism would be the major issue of the 20th century. Well, it did become a major issue, and even though much was done to address it, it has doggedly persisted right into the 21st century. Western cosmopolitan society, where most of the anti-racist activism took place in the 60s and 70s, seems to be much more sensitive to racism than non-Western societies. So, while an anti-racist attitude is an important aspect of political correctness in the West, it is not so among many Muslims from an Eastern background. This has led to complaints against Muslims and Islam as being racist, not only by those who are bent on attacking Islam, but also by black converts to Islam in the West. So, is Islam racist? What makes some Muslims racist? Can Islam be a solution to racism? To tackle these issues, we are joined by Sheikh Safiullah Khan, past student of Al-Azhar University and presently graduate student in Quranic studies at the Hawza Ilmi of Qom. Sheikh Safiullah, welcome to Minbar.
Shukran.
So the first question I think you should ask is, what does Islam say about race?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, Creator of the worlds, and choicest greetings and salutations to the final and last messenger to humanity. I think as Muslims, our first reference should be the Quran. We're reminded by verse in Surah Al-Hujarat, chapter Al-Hujarat, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Ya ayyuhan nas, inna khalaqnakum min dhakarin wa untha, wa ja'alnakum shu'uban wa qabaila lita'arafu, inna akramakum indallahi atqakum. That firstly the address is to humanity, O humankind, that we have created you from a single male and female, وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ شُعُوبًا وَقَبَائِلًا. We have made you into tribes and nations in order that you may know one another. That if we ponder over this verse, what we find is that firstly we reign from a common source. The address itself is to a common humanity. So I think the first point is Islam only recognizes, or rather there is only the human race. But within this human race, there are differences. There's no such thing as racial differences in humanity or multiracial society, but rather we are all human beings. And within this humanity, yes, we have people that are, I won't say white, you know, white is my shirt, but rather somebody who is fair, different shades of brown, I think that's better.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's nobody that's black also.
Yeah, I could vibe with that.
So I think there are different shades of brown.
Right.
And so firstly, we have this common humanity. We come from a common source. We have a common creator, right? And then also, we have been made into tribes and nations. And thereafter, the Quran says, لِتَعَارَفُ. So Islam does recognize the reality that we exist, that there are tribes, there are nations. But this is not for conflict. This is not for confrontation, but rather for cooperation. So I think, very briefly, there is only one race, and that is the human race.
Now, at the same time, I agreed that there's one race, or we can say one species, and that maybe we tend to identify as race certain distinctive features. Now, I mean, in the world, we have, for example, major groupings of people, black, brown, red, yellow, as the case might be. White and so on, all of them different, as you say, and if you permit me to quote you, I hope it's not copyrighted, different shades of brown. Does the Quran talk about this, different colors among mankind?
Yes, naturally this is introduced into the Quran as we have a verse that says, وَمِنْ آيَاتِهِ خَلْقُ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَاخْتِلَافُ أَلْسِنَتِكُمْ وَأَلْوَانِكُمْ. That of the signs of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the creation of the heavens and the earth. And وَاخْتِلَافُ أَلْسِنَتِكُمْ وَأَلْوَانِكُمْ. The differences in your tongue, in your languages, as well as in your color, your appearance. Mm. So this is And it goes on to say, إِنَّ فِي ذَٰلِكَ لَآيَاتٍ لِلْعَالَمِينَ. It is a sign for those who possess knowledge.
Right.
You know? So this is a sign for identifying our Creator, to know that we come from a common source. And similarly, we have a verse that says, هُوَ الَّذِي صَوَّرَكُمْ فَأَحْسَنَ صُوَّرَكُمْ. You know, I think the point here is that differentiation is a sign of beauty. It's through differentiation that you identify yourself, or you are identified. Now imagine if we were all Africans, or we were all Chinese, or we were all Europeans. I think the world would be a very dull place.
Right.
But it's these differences that creates the beauty in society. And knowing that Allahu Jamil yuhibbul jamal, Allah is beauty and He loves beauty. He has fashioned us. He has created us. So whatever we find in humanity is only but the reflection of this beauty of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So you find, like, for example, among some Muslims, you know, a lot of Muslims, they don't recognize the beauty in other races. For example, a lot of Muslims recognize or see beauty as white or fair-skinnedness, you know. You find very few of them, of course, outside of Africa, you know, and African Muslims. You find a lot of them tend to associate fair-skinnedness with beauty. Is this in conformity with the Quran? Where does this idea come from?
Look, I think this is purely the makings of society. This is something that's inbred. And this is something that is nurtured, right? We see how powerful the media is today, for example. I come from South Africa. I think, you know, I should be the right, I am the person that's speaking about racism.
Right. Right?
We live through racism. We experience racism. But looking at South Africa, the first time I left South Africa was at the age of 20 when I traveled to Egypt to study. And growing up in South Africa, you know, for example, we never saw white people as street workers, as cleaning the streets, right? We never saw white people begging. We never saw white people doing menial jobs, right? Whatever you saw of a white man was always, you know, some government minister. I mean, the inspectors, when we were in school. Yeah, exactly. When we were in school, for example, you would find, you know, that we would know that the match inspector has come to school. So we would all stand up in the class and see a white man is walking, you know, a science inspector in and so forth. So we were indoctrinated, right? And this is not something that we grew up to believe. You know, I remember, for example, in South Africa, you had, you know, breaking news: the first Indian pilot in South Africa, the first black train driver in South Africa. And you would think, like, you know, up till now, black people could not be train drivers, or non-white people could not fly a plane, you know. The amazing thing of South Africa, in spite of it being so advanced, television was introduced into South Africa in the late 70s. They wanted to give this impression. They did not want to broadcast, for example, you know, sitcoms and dramas and so forth that were made in Hollywood that portrayed black people in a good light.
Right.
Interesting, I remember one of the Caribbean authors, he says that in the British Foreign Office, it was part of the protocol for ambassadors and foreign servants, people that were serving abroad, that if they happened to be sick, they had to return to Mother England. They could not remain in the host country.
I see. So because they didn't want people to see them sick.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, they always had to see a white man that was in charge. You know, he doesn't get sick.
Never weak.
He is never weak, exactly. Yeah. So this impression is something that is indoctrinated, right? The first time when I landed in Athens Airport, it was 1989, and I landed on the airport and I saw, like, there were white janitors. There were white people sleeping under the chairs, you know, white people on the floor. They were, and walking around Athens, I saw white people begging. And I was like shocked, you know, I've never seen this in my life. Similarly, around that time, there was a whole lot of, you know, there was a lot of demonstrations that were taking place in Eastern Europe, the fall of collapse of communism and so forth. And then you had a lot of these, you know, the white miners in Europe, Eastern Europe,
right,
that were demonstrating, that were boycotting, demonstrating against communism and so forth.
Right.
Now, this was never portrayed in South Africa because white people could never walk in a mine.
Right.
Right? South Africa, there were only black people in mines. So this is something that is indoctrinated, something that the media spews from time to time to create a certain impression, and that's how it goes on.
So racism is basically, or racist attitude is basically something that has been nurtured into people by certain, by manipulating, the environment and that type of stuff. Now, what does Islam say is the cause of racism?
Look, I think if we reflect into the Quran again, the first crime, you know, the original sin that is spoken about was actually this perception that I'm better than him, you know. And this is on the...
Which is what racism says.
Exactly.
Yes,
you know,
or racist says. خَلَقْتَنِي
مِن نَارُ وَخَلَقْتَهُ مِن تِينَ. This was the original sin. A racist person is actually following...
You have to translate your Quran in verses because we have people who don't know...
You created me from fire and you created him from soil.
Right.
This was what Shaitan said when he was asked to bow down to Adam alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. You know, that a perceived preference, because how could he... He had no problem bowing down to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the creator. Mm-hmm. He worshipped Allah for many years, for thousands of years. But now when the command came to him that he had to bow down to Adam, he could not do that. He had no problem to continue bowing down to God, but to submit to the...
So why was he asked to bow down to Adam? Why should he bow down to Adam?
This was a form of obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And also to recognize the greatness in the creation of Adam alayhi salam. You know? But yeah, again, what we find is that this perceived excellence, based on ignorance, you know, that you created me from fire, you created him from soil, this waham, illusion, that fire is better than soil, so therefore I'm better than him. And this is something we find all the time. I think human beings, you know, we always want to feel better than the other.
Right.
Many a times it comes from an inferior complex, you know, that you suffer from an inferiority, and now you have to portray this side of you that makes you feel better. We do it all the time, you know. At times it's racist in the sense you are living in a cosmopolitan society, so you got to feel better than this person that is darker skinned than you. I won't say black, darker skin than you. But at the same time, when you are seated next to somebody who is fairer than you, you feel that, oh, he's better than you. You know, and you start aping him.
Right.
You know,
now,
so
what makes the fairer skinned man feel inferior to somebody else? I mean, you say that, for example, racism comes from somebody who has an inferiority complex, right? He feels he's inferior to somebody else, so he needs to pick on somebody else to sort of like dominate over. What about, for example, somebody who is at the head of the, at the top of the, what do you call it, I won't say the food chain, but the power chain. You know, you have a white kid living in a rich family. You know, he looks around and he sees people like him being in control, people like him being the richest people in the world, people like him being the source of emulation. What makes him feel inferior to, like, for example, a black person that would encourage him to bring out a racist...
All right. Well, yeah, it's not inferiority, right? But rather it's the perceived excellence.
Right.
He perceived excellence to be white, blue-eyed, blonde. And, naturally, if you look at it on the material sense, Europe is more advanced today. You know, they live in cleaner societies. They live in more developed communities. Everything is at the press of a button and so advanced and so forth. So there is this perception that we are better because our livelihood, the condition of our existence.
Right.
Secondly, the lifestyles that they lead. You know, they have this impression that, oh, look, for us to live this lifestyle, we have to be better. If we were not better, we would have been like these people, for example, in third world countries. So there's this perception that excellence is being, let's call it German, Hitler's boy, and being blue-eyed, being blonde, being European, living in a European society and so forth. So this is a perception that comes about from somebody like that.
Right, so you're talking about these people now, a racist person would look at his outward characteristics, you know, his material advantages, and say because of these material advantages, whether it be skin color or the type of society one is living in, this is the cause of my superiority. Does Islam agree with that? What are the criteria for establishing the idea of better or worse?
This is interesting in the sense that Islam does not take the physical or the superficial appearances as criteria for excellence. Because naturally, these things are all, this is something that we judge all the time, or we go by, you know, we always, we see the person from the outside. But Islam does not take these as criteria. Islam takes something that nobody can judge by. That إِنَّ أَكْرَمَكُمْ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ أَتْخَاكُمْ, the best amongst you is the closest, the one that is closest to Allah, the most pious amongst you. Yeah. Piety does not really translate taqwa, but that God consciousness.
Or God wariness as
God, exactly, you know. That being conscious of Allah, and He's the best amongst you. It's something that we cannot judge.
Right.
You know, so therefore, on this basis, we cannot look at the color of a person's skin. We cannot look at his physical features. We cannot look at his clothing. We can look at his appearance and say, oh, he's so and so. I need to respect him and I need to get close to him and so forth. No. But rather, Islam establishes a criteria that is purely within the knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that is God consciousness, awareness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So what that would lead people, I would assume, to a kind of caution in terms of dealing with other people, don't you think? For example, I know that the best among us is the person who is most God-wary or God-conscious. But I cannot measure God-consciousness in some way. Right. So therefore, I must assume that the person I'm talking to is more God-conscious than me, for example. And therefore, I should treat him with a greater degree of respect just because of that.
Definitely. That you do not perceive yourself to be better in any respect.
Could you say that again?
That you do not perceive yourself better in any respect.
Right.
I was on Hajj, I remember, a few years ago. And there was a point where we were marching from Muzdalifah to Mina. It was one morning. We had to reach Mina after sunrise. And at that point, you know, throughout the Hajj, I did not really feel that loneliness and that oneness. But at that point, I had my parents with me. And at that point, as we walked, I just realized for that moment that I'm one individual amongst more than 2 million people. There's nothing that differentiates me between them. You know, nobody knows that, oh, he's Safiullah and he's from South Africa and he has this degree and he has so much money and so forth. No. I just have two pieces of clothing and that's it. And if I had to collapse there, that would have been it. You know, and it struck me. I just couldn't believe it, you know, that you're nobody. Mm-hmm. And as I walked, I said, yo, it's something that we don't realize all the time. And, right. You know, I think this is what, if we speak about the Hajj, this is what comes across, you know, that you have this common humanity. Everybody, you're all human beings. You all have been created. What makes you think that you're better than the other?
Right. But, I mean, when you look at Islamic history, however, we see, for example, in a lot of Islamic literature, negative portrayals of, for example, blacks. You know, we've seen, for example, the Thousand and One Nights. You know, the reason why the king is killing all these maidens, right, is having relationships with them and killing them afterwards, is because he witnessed his wife in an adulterous relationship with a black man. You know, we see in some of the poems of even great writers in Islam, like Sa'di, again, negative portrayals of blacks. We see, for example, in some of the writings of great theoreticians, Islamic theoreticians like, you know, Sheikh Tusi, negative aspects of blacks. We see in pictures and depictions of court life, for example, you find blacks tending to be portrayed as servants and eunuchs and slaves and so forth. You see even in modern movies about Islam, right, the same thing. Apart from maybe one or two examples, for you know, Miqdad or Bilal being portrayed as something good, apart from that, you find a general negative type of an attitude. Why is this? Where does that come from?
Look, I think this will have to, will go under the heading of the Islamic Torah, you know, the Islamic legacy.
Right. Right.
Naturally, we cannot take Islam, the ideals of Islam through its legacy, but rather we have the Quran, which is the only, the final revelation that is protected from every sort of tahrif, every sort of...
Yes. What is tahrif? What is tahrif? Distortion of the text. Right, distortion of a religious text. Right. Yes.
That's protected. Mm. So if we look into the Quran, we would not find such things. And I think, therefore, it's important. For example, like you quoted, you could even find it in Hadith literature, right? That there are certain references, you know, if you see a black man in your dream or you see a black cat in your dream and so forth, this always has to be judged against the Quran. The Quran, at the end of the day, is a sift. If these things stand up against the Quran, then it's something to contend with. If not, no. You know, so this, naturally, if we look into the history of Islam, we will find a lot of discrepancies that came in as we moved on. You know, if we take, for example, if I ask you right now, you are a Muslim, what does Islam say about cleanliness?
Right, cleanliness is actually godliness.
Right, but yes. Apart from that, it's something that everything starts there.
Right.
That your prayer, everything that you do is based on your cleanliness. Right. But if I tell, and I've been to, I've lived in many Muslim countries, I've traveled to many Muslim countries, I have not seen dirtier cities than Muslim countries. Sorry about that.
Right.
Right. And Muslims are so distant from cleanliness that Islam speaks about. But are we going to say now, I wonder what Islam says about cleanliness. Just look at these Muslims.
Right.
You know, so I think the point here is, naturally, if you're going to look at Muslims, we are going to find a lot of baggage that has come in or come on as the years. But rather, if you want to look at or you want to take the Islamic perspective on things, then naturally we've got to go to the original sources.
Hold that thought. We will be right back after this news break. Stay tuned. Welcome back, and we were speaking with Sheikh Safiullah Khan from South Africa, a scholar in Quranic studies about Islam and or Muslims and racism. So we ended up, Sheikh Safiullah, with you saying that the unhygienic environment that Muslims live in today in the East, for example, are not a reflection of Islam, and therefore racist views by Muslims in the same type of sphere would not be reflective of Islam as well. Now, we have these people, we have great men writing these negative things about race. Why would this happen? What would be the causes for them to do something like that?
Look, I think generally we are the product of our societies. And naturally, we only have according to the school of Ahlul Bayt, we have 14 individuals that have been protected and guided Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, in addition to the Anbiya, the prophets that have been sent by Allah for the guidance of humanity. Apart from that, we all we commit sins, we are bound to err. Naturally, growing up in such a society where these attitudes persist, it's bound to happen that you could become racist or you could hold certain views as a result of the society you come from. Not to resolve you of any blame, no, but that's a reality that we exist in. You know, we are very much the product of the environments we come from. Unless you are able to rise above, you are able to understand the Quran, you are able to understand Islam and rise above the rest of your society. But generally, we go with the flow. I think this is majority of human society, and it's not only for when it comes to racism, it comes to everything. Right? There are very few people that are able to discern the truth from the garbage that's out there. You know, to be able to see through so many sheets of or layers of, what can I call it, barriers that exist in society.
Right. Right?
And similarly, when it comes to racism, this is what we find. For example, like early on I gave the example of South Africa, where growing up in South Africa, it would have been no crime on your behalf if you perceived that, you know, black people were created inferior, because this is what you saw portrayed in society. You know, from birth, the playing fields were never leveled, right? If I may say to you, till today, we are 13 years in a democracy in South Africa, leave alone what happened in apartheid, but 13 years in a democracy in South Africa, according to recent statistics, I think the government spends something like 80%, or maybe less. But what's very clear, that more of the budget for education goes to white children instead of black kids.
In South Africa, today?
Even today.
Uh-huh.
For numerous reasons. Right? Now imagine in the time of apartheid where 80% or more was given for the growth, the nurturing and the training of white kids. What did you expect black children to do or grow up to become? We had something in South Africa referred to as Bantu education, where black people were actually raised with this belief that we were created to be servants to white people. You know? And they were never made, according, my brother was telling, he studied in one of the local universities. He said that in his time, when he was a student in university, they found his colleagues at university and they could not read and write properly. Right? So coming back to the point, I mean, even if you look at Iran today, right, you have a few million Afghani refugees in this country, and them being refugees and the status of the situation in the country and so forth, naturally a lot of the menial jobs are given to them. Or they are forced to take it in order to survive. Now, there could be this perception out in Iranian society that, you know, Afghani people can only, you know, they are only made
menial jobs.
Menial jobs, exactly. You know, digging roads and tunnels and picking up garbage and so forth. Right? Now, if you have to tell them that, you know, I know this Afghani doctor that is in Canada or in Australia or in America, they would be, oh, I never knew there were Afghani doctors.
Right.
Or Afghani engineers, for example, you know. So this perception in society does exist. And therefore, you know, I think one of the benefits of traveling in order to remove the ignorance that exists in society is getting out of these barriers that exist.
Right. Coming out of your box.
Coming out of your cocoon.
Right, right. Now, right. I want to ask you, how did the prophet and great... Now, you mentioned that basically this is one of the problems that mankind faces naturally, you know, to fall under the influence of his environment. And if his environment has negative characteristics or negative attitudes, for example, to race, for example, a person would fall into that. How did the Prophet and great Muslim leaders deal with this? How did they deal with racism?
Look, I think, firstly, racism stems from ignorance. So we've got to do away with ignorance. We've got to promote education knowledge.
Right.
So firstly is to educate.
Yeah. Right? So they educated the people?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Not only education, but rather in practice, in a practical lifestyle. Right. Because education itself is not necessary. There has to be this human model that exists from the outside.
Right.
Interacting, interrelating, right? Dealing with one another. If we look at Islam, Islam came in a society that was steeped into racism, steeped into class differences, into discrimination and so forth. I think if we look into the history of Islam, the fears of people like Abu Sufyan and Abu Jahl and their likes was not that Islam was introducing the belief in one God, but rather the implications that came with Islam. Because Islam, the nature of Islam is to change, is to institute change, is to bring about a new society. Based on what? Based on the belief in one creator, but also based on justice, human justice, social justice. You know, the fears that these people had was that if we become Muslim, then the likes of Bilal and Ammar and Salman, you know, there'll be no difference with us. These very same people that we considered inferior and slaves, they will be seated with us, eating on the same table, but more than that, they could marry from our woman. They could take our daughters. And this was the fear. The implications that Islam was to bring about. And naturally, Islam being diametrically opposed to racism and for all forms of discrimination, this was a challenge for them. So the threat was the breakup of the culture or the system of Quraysh. And this is what they fear. It's quoted by Abu Sufyan that at one point he said that, I know these idols mean nothing, they have no purpose. But the idols is what kept people at bay. It what kept people under occupation.
Right.
And this is what was important about the idols.
Yeah.
Now, so what did the prophet and the great leaders, can you give me some examples maybe of individual instances where they confronted racism and what did they do?
Look, I think very foremost is that Islam itself was a beacon of freedom for the slaves, for the downtrodden, for the oppressed. They had the most to gain by becoming Muslims. And therefore, you find the early Muslims were of that so-called that class of society, the downtrodden in society. You know, and this is not something that was, it's only regarding our prophet, but the Quran speaks about regarding all prophets. You know, that you find, the Quran says that, you know, the rich would come to the prophet and they would say to them, you know, are you associating with these downtrodden in society? If you distance yourself from them, we would join you. Or they would say, if this was a better religion, then we would have become Muslims first. Because the slaves beat, so-called slaves beat them to accepting the message of the prophet. So they sort of analyzed it, you know, that, oh, if this was a good message, you would have been the first to accept it. You know? And similarly, you find that the Quran, all prophets were confronted by those that the Quran says, refers to them as mutrafi, you know, those that were the bourgeois in society. Right? So, you know, they were the first to confront the message of change. They feared the social power, the stronghold that they have on society. And similarly, when you look in the life of the Prophet ﷺ, that, you know, the people that he trusted, the people that he depended, not only in the life of the Prophet, but thereafter, that even the those that followed behind the Prophet ﷺ, his successors, they very much depended on this core group in the Muslim community. You know, so the oppressed of yesterday became the leaders of today. And this is something that we find in the Quran. I mean, one of the favors of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is that وَنُرِيدُ أَنَّمُنَّ عَلَى الَّذِينَ اسْتُضْعِفُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ. We want to be gracious to those that are oppressed in this world, make them leaders and make them inheritors. Mm-hmm. You know? So I think, to sum it up, Islam is actually turning the tables around.
All right. Now, one excuse that some Muslims use, first of all, a very, very sensitive subject, especially in a cosmopolitan society among Muslims, is the question of interracial marriages, right? Blacks and Indians, whites and blacks, whites and Indians, whites and Arabs, blacks and Arabs, and so forth and so on. It's very, very sensitive. One excuse that those who are opposed to it say is that we're not against it because of the racial aspect. We're against it because of the cultural aspect. The cultural differences are too great to afford marital harmony. What is your response to that?
Look, I think 2 points. There's the existing reality, and then there is the, let's call it the anti-Islamic influence. The existing reality, we find this in the case of the Prophet ﷺ and the marriage of Zainab bint Jahsh, right, where he got his cousin, he got married to his so-called slave, Zaid bin Harith. Right? Zainab came from high-class society. Zaid was bought into was sold into slavery. Right? And in spite of the Prophet ﷺ arranging this marriage, it did not work because of the differences that existed between Zayd and Zainab. Zainab was always...
The class differences.
The
basically.
Class differences, right? So there is that reality, right? And we need to be conscious of that. We do not live in an ideal society, in an right. ideal world where, you know, these things are not to be looked at.
In Islam, we have the whole concept of kuf, compatibility.
Compatibility, exactly. Yeah. So if this comes within the framework of compatibility, then yes, it's something to look at. However, if we are speaking about cultural aspects, or if we are speaking about Islam versus culture, you know, that like the example you gave, right? We have this, we have a society where A and B, or let's say Maryam and Ahmad, are growing up together. They grew up in this society, influenced by this, born in this society, growing up in this society, influenced by this society, going to the same school, same environment, and so forth, and so forth. And now they come to the point where they want to get married, and then you come, oh, this is not possible, you know. My daughter is Turkish, and you are Iranian. It's not possible, you know. I don't know what excuses they will make.
Right.
But this is, I think, the problem that we have here is where culture is from Islam. You know, we have Muslims that are culturally Muslims, and then we have Muslims that are ideally Muslims, you know, that are based on principles, based on concepts, and not I'm a born Muslim and I grew up to become a Muslim, I grew up as a Muslim, right? So when we have this conflict between culture and Islam, then naturally this is bound to happen. But if we use
Islam serving culture versus culture serving Islam, so
but if we use Islam as the framework, the point of reference, that, you know, yes, I am Turkish and you are, what do you want to call it? French? German?
Whatever. Chinese?
But I'm a Muslim. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. You know? I don't have a problem if you want to eat chilo kebab. And I don't have a problem if you want to eat sabzi.
Right.
Right? But the thing is that we eat halal food. And
I mean, you really find in a lot of these countries exactly what you're saying. You know, you find these people, let's say in Toronto, Canada, or New York, right? Everybody, all the Muslims, have a common public culture. You know, you find that, for example, the kids of like Pakistanis, for example, don't know Urdu. They might be able to understand it,
but they don't speak it.
You know, and so you find more
so
common.
English is the common language.
Exactly. You know what I mean? The values are common. You find these kids, for example, being very different to their parents in terms of the culture back home and so on. You know, when bring up
so if, you know, if I don't have a problem you eating this food, you know, if it, you want spicy food, I don't have a problem eating it, but make sure you eat halal.
Mm.
And I think that's what Islam wants.
Right.
I don't have a problem you dressing in a certain manner, but the thing is, wear hijab.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Islam, I think this is against the beauty of Islam. You know, Islam has not come to the nitty-gritty of, you know, you need to eat A, B, and C, and you need to dress in A, B, and C. No. But rather, Islam has given that general framework, right? You need to, Islam did not say how you must cover. It said what you must cover. Now, whether you want to use, you know, Eastern dress, whether you want to use Western dress, it's up to you.
Mm-hmm.
But it should be covering the parts that require to be covered. It should be modest dress. Similarly, when it comes to your food, you can eat and eat as much as you want and eat whatever you want. But make sure what you eat is halal. You know, so I think if the point of reference is Islam, I'm not going to say that there's no problems. Problems will come about, right? But the reality is, the common point of reference is Islam. So if there is any disputes, we can always refer to this common reference, and that itself could resolve problems.
So what do you think Muslims can do to resolve and eliminate the problems of race among them, or racist attitudes among them? Muslims today, what can they do to do that?
Like we said, I think firstly was knowledge. Moving out of those barriers that we exist, that we find, right? You know, we need to go out and experience the life, experience the world. I think many a times is we fear the unknown. You know, we fear what we don't know. We are very complacent with what we know. We don't like change. You know, that goes for a good percentage of humanity. We need to come out of those closets, those cocoons, those comfort zones that we live in, and experience the world. You know, once you come out and you realize that, oh, know, there's no difference between him and I. I'll give you an example. When I went to Egypt, being a Muslim, coming to Egypt to study, first I had to study Arabic, Al-Azhar University. I never knew Arabic. And then I come to Egypt and I find the best speaking Arabic students, best speaking Arabic students, happen to be African students and from West Africa. And there I look at myself and I said, yo, I'm from South Africa, I'm Muslim, born Muslim, I was a hafiz of the Quran, but I couldn't speak Arabic. And here are my colleagues, black, like I said, a dark shade of brown, and they were speaking Arabic eloquently and fluently. And it struck me, and I said, yo, if I compare myself with these people, you know, in that sense, they are so-called better than me. You know, Allah gave them this ability to speak. And then, well, looking at it further, I realized that they have these institutions in their countries, that they study Arabic at a very early age. And to amazing here was they had not traveled to an Arabic-speaking country before coming to Egypt. Mm-hmm. They learned it in their hometowns. And they were fluent. You know, and this struck me that, you know, you need to rethink a lot of things. So I think, you know, especially cosmopolitan societies where we have this mixture in our communities, it's important to get to know one another, to move out of these safe zones, engage, intermingle. I think this is what Islam is all about. If you look at the Hajj, right? I remember a few years ago, after I returned from the Hajj, and you know, when you take the photographs, you don't really notice the people that are around you. Right? You just take a photo of me and that's it, and you go ahead. But when I came back home and I looked at these photographs, and I was amazed to see the people around, you know, the bystanders,
right. The
what do you want to call them? The
people in the background.
People in the background.
Yeah.
That just happened to be there. I was shocked. You know, that just look at the beauty of Islam, you know. So I think we need to move out of these comfort zones, these safe zones, these closets that we have for ourselves. Mm. So firstly, knowledge. Secondly, coming out of these barriers or breaking these barriers that we have, intermingling, getting to know one another. And once you get to know the other, you know, you realize, you know, this diversity that exists in Islam. And I think, you know...
You break down the barriers of the unknown.
Exactly, you know, this is what gives more meaning to being a Muslim, is this diversity that exists. And this is, it only enriches this experience of humanity moving towards perfection.
How about the young Muslims confronting racial attitudes among their parents? How could they deal with that?
Look, you know, I think that's going to be a stumbling block, right? At times you may have parents that will not be able to deal with it. I come from South Africa. My parents, I'm fortunate to say that, you know, we never grew up with this mindset that my parents never at once said to us, in spite of us growing up in a society where we were distinct, you know, so-called Indians lived here, and so-called blacks lived here, and so-called whites lived here. There was no interaction. We went to so-called Indian schools. You were never made to interact with others. You couldn't interact with one another, right? But not at once did any of my parents say to me that, listen, you know, these are inferior and those are superior and you need to be with them and you should not be with them and so forth, you know? So there are parents, yes, I think that have grown above this, but at times it could be a stumbling block, you know? Parents that are not able to deal with change. You know, again, coming to ignorance, coming to fear. I think the bottom line is what we always need to do is to judge ourselves against the criteria that has been set by Islam. You know, if you want to be, if you claim to be a Muslim, if you claim to be a practicing Muslim, and I'm sure all these parents will say that, you know, one of the things that they cling on to is being Muslim, you know, keeping on to their culture that they came with from the East. Right? So that's good. So now you need to challenge them on that culture. Oh, so, you know, you keep to Urdu because for you it's a sacred language. You don't have a problem with that. You keep to this culture because you feel this is what has kept you a Muslim. You don't have a problem with that. But now again, let's look at this. What you do and what you say goes against the very grain of Islam. Now, how can you still consider yourself to be a good Muslim? You know? So I think, naturally, in a good manner, in a nice manner, we need to deal with those things. You need to confront it, but in a nice manner that does not create division and so forth.
We have about 2 more minutes. What could Islam show the world in terms of being a leader in the struggle against racism?
You know, the beauty of Islam, something that, you know, descends from our Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam, that he was a living example of the Quran. Right? A lot that can be read into this. That firstly, the Quran is purely a book of text. The Quran can only come to life, it comes alive when it is reflected in a human being. Right? And therefore the need for this individual to be constantly guided from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Right? And this is where the beauty of Islam was seen. That in this individual and many of those who followed thereafter in his path, the beauty of Islam has been seen. I think the challenge to us as Muslims today is to relive, or to live this Quran, the Quranic experience in our lives. You know that we have this hadith of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, where he says, "Kunu du'atan lana bighayri al-sinatikum." Be inviters onto our path without your tongues, through your actions. You know, actions speak louder than words. I mean, if we see this living model of Islam, there's nothing that can deny it.
And with that, I want to thank you for joining us here at Minbar. And I hope you are a guest again in the future. I want to thank you for watching. We ask that if you have any questions, comments, or criticisms, don't forget to write us at minbar@presstv.ir. That's minbar@presstv.ir. And until the next show, I will see you here, same time, same channel, on Minbar.